over a second hearth. But there was not a cook to be seen, nor any living soul except the dog. Thankful for Orban's lies, he hurried on into the night. The stable was a large structure of the same stone as the inn, though only the stone faces around the big doors had been polished. A single lantern hanging from a stall post gave a dim light. Stepper and the other horses stood in stalls near the doors. Loyal's big mount nearly filled his. The smell of hay and horses was familiar and comforting. Perrin was the first to arrive. There was only one stableman on duty, a narrow-faced fellow in a dirty shirt with lanky gray hair who demanded to know who Perrin was to order four horses saddled, and who was his master, and what was he doing all bundled up to travel in the middle of the night, and did Master Ferlin know he was sneaking off like this, and what did he have hidden in those saddlebags, and what was wrong with his eyes, was he sick? A coin flipped through the air from behind Perrin, glinting gold in the lantern light. The stableman snagged it with one hand and bit it. "Saddle them," Lan said. His voice was soft, as cold iron is soft, and the stableman bobbed a bow and scurried to make the horses ready. Moraine and Loyal came into the stable just as they could take up their reins, and then they were all leading their horses behind Lan, off down a street that ran behind the stable toward the river. The soft clop of the horses' hooves on the paving blocks attracted only a slat-ribbed dog that barked once and ran away as they went by.
"This brings back memories, doesn't it, Perrin?" Loyal said, quietly for him.
"Keep your voice down," Perrin whispered. "What memories?"
"Why, it is like old times."
The Ogier had managed to mute his voice. He sounded like a bumblebee, only the size of a dog instead of a horse.
"Sneaking away in the night with enemies behind us, and maybe enemies ahead, and danger in the air, and the cold tang of adventure."
Perrin frowned at Loyal over Stepper's saddle. It was easy enough. His eyes cleared the saddle, and Loyal stood head and shoulders and chest above it on the other side.
"What are you talking about? I believe you are coming to like danger. Loyal, you must be crazy."
"I'm only fixing the mood in my head,"
Loyal said, sounding formal, or perhaps defensive.
"For my book. I have to put it all in. I believe I am coming to like it, adventuring. Of course I am."
His ears gave two violent twitches.
"I have to like it if I wish to write of it."
Perrin shook his head. At the stone wharves, the barge-like ferries lay snugged for the night, still and dark, as did most of the ships. Lantern lights and people moved around on the dock alongside a two-masted vessel, though, and on the deck as well. The main smells were tar and rope, with strong hints of fish, though something back in the nearest warehouse gave off sharp, spicy aromas that the others nearly submerged. Lan located the captain, a short, slight man, with an odd way of holding his head tilted to one side while he listened. The bargaining was over soon enough, and booms and sling rigged to hoist the horses aboard. Perrin kept a close eye on the horses, talking to them. Horses had little tolerance for the unusual, such as being lifted into the air. But even the warder's stallion seemed soothed by his murmurs. Lan gave gold to the captain and silver to two sailors who ran barefoot to a warehouse for sacks of oats. More crewmen tethered the horses between the masts in a sort of small pen made of rope, all the while muttering about the mess they would have to clean. Perrin did not think anyone was supposed to overhear, but his ears caught the words. The men were just not used to horses. In short order, the Snow Goose was ready to sail, only a little ahead of what the captain— his name was Jayan Adara, had intended. Lan led Moraine below as the lines were cast off, and Loyal followed, yawning. Perrin stayed at the railing near the bow, though the Ogier's every yawn had summoned one of his own. He wondered if the Snow Goose could outrun wolves down the river, outrun dreams. Men began readying the sweeps to push the vessel away from the wharf. As the last line was tossed ashore and seized by a dockman, a girl in narrow, divided skirts burst out of the shadows between two warehouses, a bundle in her arms and a dark cloak streaming behind her. She leaped onto the deck just as the men at the sweeps began pushing off.
Adara bustled from his place by the tiller, but she calmly set down her bundle and said briskly, "I will take passage downriver. Oh, say as far as he is going." She nodded toward Perrin without looking at him. "I have no objections to sleeping on deck. Cold and wet do not bother me."
A few minutes of bargaining followed. She passed over 3 silver marks, frowned at the copper she got back, then stuffed them into her purse and came forward to stand beside Perrin. She had an herbal scent to her, light and fresh and clean. Those dark, tilted eyes regarded him over high cheekbones, then turned to look back toward shore. She was about his own age, he decided. He could not decide if her nose fit her face or dominated it.
"You are a fool, Perrin Ebarra. Why care what she looks like?"
The gap to the wharf was a good 20 paces now, the sweeps dug in, cutting white furrows in black water. For a moment, he considered tossing her over the side.
"Well," she said after a moment, "I never expected my travels to take me back to Ilion so soon as this."
Her voice was high, and she had a flat way of speaking, but it was not unpleasant.
"You are going to Ilion, are you not?"
He tightened his mouth.
"Don't sulk," she said. "You left quite a mess back there, you and that Aielman between you. The uproar was just beginning when I left." "You did not tell them?" he said in surprise. "The townsfolk think the Aielman chewed through the chain or broke it with his bare hands. They had not decided which when I left."
She made a sound suspiciously like a giggle.
"Orban was quite loud in his disgust that his wounds would keep him from hunting down the Aielman personally."
Perrin snorted. "If he ever sees an Aiel again, he'll bloody soil himself." He cleared his throat and muttered, "Sorry."
"I do not know about that," she said, as if his remark had been nothing out of the way. "I saw him in Johanna during the winter. He fought 4 men together, killed 2, and made the other 2 yield. Of course, he started the fight, so that takes something away from it. But they knew what they were doing. He did not pick a fight with men who could not defend themselves. Still, he is a fool. He has these peculiar ideas about the great black wood, what some call the Forest of Shadows. Have you ever heard of it?"
He eyed her sideways. She spoke of fighting and killing as calmly as another woman might speak of baking. He had never heard of any great blackwood, but the Forest of Shadows lay just south of the 2 rivers.
"Are you following me? You were staring at me back at the inn. Why? And why didn't you tell them what you saw?" "An ogier," she said, staring at the river, "is obviously an ogier. And the others were not much more difficult to figure out. I managed a much better look inside Lady Alice's hood than Orban did, and her face makes that stone-faced fellow a warder. The light burned me if I'd want that one angry with me. Does he always look like that, or did he eat a rock for his last meal? Anyway, that left only you. I do not like things I cannot account for."
Once again, he considered tossing her over the side. Seriously, this time. But Remen was now only a blotch of light well behind them in the darkness, and no telling how far it was to shore. She seemed to take his silence as an urging to go on.
"So there I have an..."
She looked around, then dropped her voice, though the closest crewman was working a sweep 10 feet away.
"An Aes Sedai, a warder, and ogier, and you. A countryman by first look at you."
Her tilted eyes rose to study his yellow ones intently. He refused to look away, and she smiled.
"Only you free a caged Aielman, hold a long talk with him, then help him chop 12 white cloaks into sausage. I assume you do this regularly. You certainly looked as if it were nothing out of the ordinary for you. I sense something strange in a party of travelers such as yours, and strange trails are what hunters look for."
He blinked. There was no mistaking that emphasis.
"A hunter? You? You cannot be a hunter. You are a girl."
Her smile became so innocent that he almost walked away from her. She stepped back, made a flourish with each hand, and was holding two knives as neatly as old Tom Maryland could have done it. One of the men at the sweeps made a choking sound, and two others stumbled. Sweeps thrashed and tangled, and the Snow Goose lurched a little before the captain's shouts set things right. By that time, the black-haired girl had made the knives disappear again. "Nimble fingers and nimble wits will take you a good deal further than a sword and muscles. Sharp eyes help as well, but fortunately, I have these things." "And modesty as well," Perrin murmured. She did not seem to notice. "I took the oath and received the blessing in the great square at Tamaz in Ilion. Perhaps I was the youngest, but in that crowd, with all the trumpets and drums and cymbals and shouting, a 6-year-old could have taken the oath and none would have noticed. There were over 1,000 of us, perhaps 2, and every one with an idea of where to find the Horn of Valir. I have mine. It still may be the right one, but no hunter can afford to pass up a strange trail. The horn will certainly lie at the end of a strange trail, and I have never seen one any stranger than the trail you 4 make. Where are you bound? Ilion? Somewhere else?"
"What was your idea," he asked, "about where the horn is?"
"Safe in Tarvalin, I hope, and the light send I never see it again."
"You think it's in Giladon?"
She frowned at him. He had the feeling she did not give up a scent once she had raised it, but he was ready to offer her as many side trails as she would take. Then said, "Have you ever heard of Manetherin?"
He nearly choked. "I have heard of it," he said cautiously.
"Every queen of Manetherin was an Aes Sedai, and the king the warder bound to her. I can't imagine a place like that, but that is what the book says. It was a large land, most of Andor and Giladon and more besides. But the capital, the city itself, was in the mountains of mist. That is where I think the horn is, unless you 4 lead me to it."
His hackles stirred. She was lecturing him as if he were an untaught village lout. "You'll not find the horn or Manetherin. The city was destroyed during the Trolloc Wars, when the last queen drew too much of the one power to destroy the dreadlords who had killed her husband."
Moraine had told him the names of that king and queen, but he did not remember them. "Not in Manetherin, farm boy," she said calmly, "though a land such as that would make a good hiding place. But there were other nations, other cities, in the Mountains of Mist, so old that not even Aes Sedai remember them. And think of all those stories about it being bad luck to enter the mountains. What better place for the horn to be hidden than in one of those forgotten cities?"
"I have heard stories of something hidden in the mountains." Would she believe him? He had never been good at lying. "The stories did not say what, but it's supposed to be the greatest treasure in the world. So maybe it is the horn. But the mountains of mist stretch for hundreds of leagues. If you are going to find it, you should not waste time following us. You'll need it all to find the horn before Orban and Gon."
"I told you. Those 2 have some strange idea the horn is hidden in the great Blackwood." She smiled up at him. Her mouth was not too big at all when she smiled. "And I told you a hunter has to follow strange trails. You are lucky Orban and Gon were injured fighting all those Aielmen, or they might well be aboard too. At least I will not get in your way, or try to take cover, or pick a fight with the warder."
He growled disgustedly. "We are just travelers on our way to Ilion, girl. What is your name? If I have to share this ship with you for days yet, I can't keep calling you girl."
"I call myself Mondarb."
He could not stop the guffaw that burst out of him. Those tilted eyes regarded him with heat.
"I will teach you something, farm boy."
Her voice remained level, barely.
"In the old tongue, Mondarb means blade. It is a name worthy of a hunter of the horn."
He managed to get his laughter under control and hardly wheezed at all as he pointed to the rope pen between the masts. "You see that black stallion? His name is Mondarb.
The heat went out of her eyes, and spots of color bloomed on her cheeks.
Oh. I was born Zareen Bashir, but Zareen is no name for a hunter. In the stories, hunters have names like Rogosh Eagle Eye.
She looked so crestfallen that he hastened to say, I like the name Zareen. It suits you. The heat flashed back into her eyes, and for a moment he thought she was about to produce one of her knives again. It is late, Zareen. I want some sleep. He turned his back to start for the hatch that led below deck, prickles running across his shoulders. Crewmen still padded up the deck and back, working the sweeps.
Fool, a girl would not stick a knife in me. Not with all these people watching. Would she?
Just as he reached the hatch, she called to him.
Farm boy, perhaps I will call myself Fail. My father used to call me that when I was little. It means falcon.
He stiffened and almost missed the first step of the ladder.
Coincidence?
He made himself go down without looking back toward her.
It has to be.
The passageway was dark, but enough moonlight filtered down behind him for him to make his way. Someone was snoring loudly in one of the cabins.
Min, why did you have to go seeing things?
Chapter 36. Daughter of the Night. Realizing that he had no way of knowing which cabin was supposed to be his, he put his head into several. They were dark, and all of them had two men asleep in the narrow beds built against each side, all but one, which held Loyal, sitting on the floor, between the beds, and barely fitting, scribbling in his cloth-bound book of notes by the light of a gimbaled lantern. The Ogier wanted to talk about the events of the day, but Perrin, jaws creaking with the effort of holding his yawns in, thought the ship must have run far enough downriver by now to make it safe to sleep. Safe to dream. Even if they tried, wolves could not long keep pace with the sweeps and the current. Finally, he found a windowless cabin with no one in it at all, which suited him just as well. He wanted to be alone.
A coincidence in the name, that's all, he thought, as he lit the lantern mounted on the wall. Anyway, her real name is Zareen.
But the girl with the high cheekbones and dark, tilted eyes was not uppermost in his thoughts. He put his bow and other belongings on one cramped bed, tossed his cloak over them, and sat on the other to tug off his boots. Elias Machira had found a way to live with what he was, a man somehow linked with wolves, and he had not gone mad. Thinking back, Perrin was sure Elias had been living that way for years before he ever met the man.
He wants to be that way. He accepts it anyway.
That was no solution. Perrin did not want to live that way, did not want to accept it.
But if you have the bar stock to make a knife, you accept it and make a knife, even if you'd like a wood axe. No, my life is more than iron to be hammered into shape.
Cautiously, he reached out with his mind, feeling for wolves, and found nothing. Oh, there was a dim impression of wolves somewhere in the distance, but it faded even as he touched it. For the first time in so long, he was alone. Blessedly alone. Blowing out the lantern, he lay down for the first time in days.
How in the light will Loyal manage in one of these?
Those all but sleepless nights rolled over him, exhaustion slacking his muscles. It came to him that he had managed to put the Aiel out of his head. And the white cloaks.
Light forsaken axe. Burn me, I wish I had never seen it,
was his last thought before sleep. Thick gray fog surrounded him, dense enough low down that he could not see his own boots, and so heavy on every side that he could not make out anything 10 paces away. There was surely nothing nearer. Anything at all might lie within it. The mist did not feel right. There was no dampness to it. He put a hand to his belt, seeking the comfort of knowing he could defend himself, and gave a start. His axe was not there. Something moved in the fog, a swirling in the grayness. Something coming his way. He tensed, wondering if it was better to run or stand and fight with his bare hands, wondering if there was anything to fight. The billowing furrow boring through the fog resolved itself into a wolf. a shaggy form almost one with the heavy mist.
Hopper?
The wolf hesitated, then came to stand beside him. It was Hopper, he was certain, but something about the wolf's stance, something in the yellow eyes that looked up briefly to meet his, demanded silence, in mind as well as body. Those eyes demanded that he follow, too. He laid a hand on the wolf's back, and as he did, Hopper started forward. He let himself be led. The fur under his hand was thick and shaggy. It felt real. The fog began to thicken until only his hand told him Hopper was still there. Until a glance down did not even show him his own chest. Just gray mist. He might as well have been wrapped in new sheared wool for all he could see. It struck him that he had heard nothing either. Not even the sound of his own footsteps. He wiggled his toes and was relieved to feel the boots on his feet. The gray became darker, and he and the wolf walked through pitch blackness. He could not see his hand when he touched his nose. He could not see his nose, for that matter. He tried closing his eyes for a moment and could not tell any difference. There was still no sound. His hand felt the rough hair of Hopper's back, but he was not sure he could feel anything under his boots. Suddenly, Hopper stopped, forcing him to halt, too. He looked around and snapped his eyes shut. He could tell a difference now. And feel something, too, a queasy twisting of his stomach. He made himself open his eyes and look down. What he saw could not have been there, not unless he and Hopper were standing in midair. He could see nothing of the wolf or himself, as if neither had bodies at all. That thought nearly tied his stomach into knots. But below him, as clear as if lit by a thousand lamps, stretched a vast array of mirrors, seemingly hanging in blackness, though as level as if they stood on a vast floor. They stretched as far as he could see in every direction, but right beneath his feet there was a clear space, and people in it. Suddenly he could hear their voices as well as if he had been standing among them.
"Great Lord," one of the men muttered. "Where is this place?"
He looked around once, flinching at his image cast back at him many thousandfold, and held his eyes forward after that. The others huddled around him, seemed even more afraid.
"I was asleep in Tarvalin, Great Lord. I am asleep in Tarvalin. Where is this place? Have I gone mad?"
Some of the men around him wore ornate coats full of embroidery, others plainer garb, while some seemed to be naked or in their small clothes.
"I too sleep," a naked man nearly screamed, "in Tyr. I remember lying down with my wife." "And I do sleep in Ilion," a man in red and gold said, sounding shaken. "I know that I do sleep, but that cannot be. I know that I do dream, but that does be impossible. Where does this be, Great Lord? Are you really come to me?"
The dark-haired man who faced them was garbed in black, with silver lace at his throat and wrists. Now and again he put a hand to his chest as if it hurt him. There was light everywhere down there, coming from nowhere, but this man below Perrin seemed cloaked in shadow. Darkness rolled around him, caressed him.
"Silence!"
The black-cloaked man did not speak loudly, but he had no need to. For the space of that word he had raised his head. His eyes and mouth were holes boring into a raging forge fire, all flame and fiery glow. Perrin knew him then. Baal Zemon. He was staring down at Baal Zemon himself. Fear struck through him like hammered spikes. He would have run, but he could not feel his feet. Hopper shifted. He felt the thick fur under his hand and gripped it hard. Something real. Something more really hoped than what he saw. But he knew that both were real. The men huddling together cowered.
"You have been given tasks," Baal Zemon said. "Some of these tasks you have carried out. At others, you have failed."
Now and again his eyes and mouth vanished in flame again, and the mirrors flashed with reflected fire.
"Those who have been marked for death must die. Those who have been marked for taking must bow to me. To fail the great Lord of the Dark cannot be forgiven.
Fire shone through his eyes, and the darkness around him roiled and spun.
You!
His finger pointed at the man who had spoken of Tarvalin, a fellow dressed like a merchant in plainly cut clothes of the finest cloth. The others shied away from him, as if he had black bile fever, leaving him to cower alone.
You allowed the boy to escape Tarvalin!
The man screamed and began to quiver like a file struck against an anvil. He seemed to become less solid, and his scream thinned with him.
You all dream, Balsamon said. But what happens in this dream is real.
The shrieking man was only a bundle of mist shaped like a man, his scream far distant, and then even the mist was gone.
I fear he will never wake.
He laughed, and his mouth roared flame.
The rest of you will not fail me again. Begone. Wake and obey.
The other men vanished. For a moment, Balsamon stood alone. Then suddenly there was a woman with him, clad all in white and silver. Shock hit Perrin. He could never forget a woman so beautiful. She was the woman from his dream, the one who had urged him to glory. An ornate silver throne appeared behind her, and she sat, carefully arranging her silken skirts.
You make free use of my domain, she said.
Your domain, Balsamon said. You claim it yours, then? Do you no longer serve the great Lord of the Dark?
The darkness around him thickened for an instant, seemed to boil.
I serve, she said quickly. I have served the Lord of the Twilight long. Long did I lie imprisoned for my service in an endless, dreamless sleep. Only Grey Men and Myrdral are denied dreams. Even Trollocs can dream. Dreams were always mine, to use and walk. Now I am free again, and I will use what is mine.
What is yours, Balsamon said.
The blackness swirling round him seemed mirthful.
You always thought yourself greater than you were, Lanfear.
The name cut at Perrin like a newly honed knife. One of the Forsaken had been in his dreams. Moraine had been right. Some of them were free. The woman in white was on her feet, the throne gone.
I am as great as I am. What have your plans come to? 3,000 years and more of whispering in ears and pulling the strings of throned puppets like an Aes Sedai.
Her voice invested the name with all scorn.
3,000 years, and yet Luz Theron walks the world again, and these Aes Sedai all but have him leashed. Can you control him? Can you turn him? He was mine before ever that straw-haired chit Ilyena saw him. He will be mine again. Do you serve yourself now, Lanfear?
Balsamon's voice was soft, but flame raged continuously in his red eyes and mouth.
Have you abandoned your oaths to the great Lord of the Dark?
For an instant, the darkness nearly obliterated him, only the glowing fires showing through.
They are not so easily broken as the oaths to the light you forsook, proclaiming your new master in the very hall of the servants. Your master claims you forever, Lanfear. Will you serve, or do you choose an eternity of pain, of endless dying without release?
I serve.
Despite her words, she stood tall and defiant.
I serve the great Lord of the Dark and none other. Forever.
The vast array of mirror began to vanish, as if black waves rolled in over it, ever closer to the center. The tide rolled over Baalzamon and Lanfear. There was only blackness. Perrin felt Hopper move, and he was more than glad to follow, guided only by the feel of fur under his hand. It was not until he was moving that he realized he could. He tried to puzzle out what he had seen without any success.
Balzamon and Lanfear. His tongue stuck to the roof of his mouth. For some reason, Lanfear frightened him more than Balzamon did. Perhaps because she had been in his dreams in the mountains.
Light, one of the Forsaken in my dreams. Light.
And unless he had missed something, she had defied the Dark One. He had been told and taught that the Shadow could have no power over you if you denied it. But how could a Dark Friend, not just a Dark Friend, one of the Forsaken, defy the Shadow? I must be mad, like Simeon's brother. These dreams have driven me mad. Slowly the blackness became fog again, and the fog gradually thinned until he walked out of it with Hopper onto a grassy hillside bright with daylight. Birds began to sing from a thicket at the foot of the hill. He looked back. A hilly plain dotted with clumps of trees stretched to the horizon. There was no sign of fog anywhere. The big grizzled wolf stood watching him. "What was that?" he demanded, struggling in his mind to turn the question to thoughts the wolf could understand. "Why did you show it to me? What was it?" Emotions and images flooded his thoughts, and his mind put words to them.
"What you must see. Be careful, young bull. This place is dangerous. Be wary as a cub hunting porcupine."
That came as something closer to small thornyback, but his mind named the animal the way he knew it as a man.
"You are too young, too new."
Was it real?
All is real, what is seen and what is not seen.
That seemed to be all the answer Hopper was going to give.
"Hopper, how are you here? I saw you die. I felt you die." "All are here. All brothers and sisters that are, all that were, all that will be."
Perrin knew that wolves did not smile, not the way humans did, but for an instant he had the impression that Hopper was grinning.
"Here I soar like the eagle."
The wolf gathered himself and leaped up into the air. Up and up it carried him until he dwindled to a speck in the sky, and a last thought came.
"To soar."
Perrin stared after him with his mouth hanging open.
"He did it."
His eyes burned suddenly, and he cleared his throat and scrubbed at his nose.
"I will be crying like a girl next."
Without thinking, he looked around to see if anyone had seen him, and that quickly everything changed. He was standing on a rise with shadowy indistinct dips and swells all around him. They seemed to fade into the distance too soon. Rand stood below him. Rand and a ragged circle of Myrdral and men and women, his eyes seemed to slide right past. Dogs howled somewhere in the distance, and Perrin knew they were hunting something. Myrdral scent and the stink of burned sulfur filled the air. Perrin's hackles rose. The circle of Myrdral and people came closer to Rand, all walking as if asleep, and Rand began to kill them. Balls of fire flew from his hands and consumed two. Lightning flashed from above to shrivel others. Bars of light like white-hot steel flew from his fists to more. And the survivors continued to walk slowly closer, as if none of them saw what was happening. One by one they died until none were left, and Rand sank down on his knees, panting. Perrin was not sure whether he was laughing or crying. It seemed to be some of each. Shapes appeared over the rises, more people coming, more Myrdral, all intent on Rand. Perrin cupped his hands to his mouth.
"Rand! Rand! There are more coming!"
Rand looked up at him from his crouch, snarling, sweat slicking his face.
"Rand! There! Burn you!"
Rand howled. Light burned Perrin's eyes, and pain seared everything. Groaning, he rolled into a ball on the narrow bed, the light still burning behind his eyelids. His chest hurt. He raised a hand to it and winced when he felt a burn under his shirt, a spot no bigger than a silver penny. Bit by bit, he forced his knotted muscles to let him straighten his legs and lie flat in the dark cabin.
"Moraine. I have to tell Moraine this time. Just have to wait till the pain goes away."
But as the pain began to fade, exhaustion took him. He barely had a thought that he must get up before sleep pulled him down again. When he opened his eyes again, he lay staring at the beams overhead. Light at the top and bottom of the door told him morning had come. He put a hand to his chest to convince himself he had imagined it. Imagined it so well that he had actually felt a burn. His fingers found the burn. I didn't imagine it then. He had dim memories of a few other dreams, fading even as he recalled them. Ordinary dreams. He even felt as if he had had a good night's sleep, and could use another one right now. But it meant he could sleep. As long as there are no wolves around, anyway. He remembered making a decision in that brief waking after the dream with Hopper, and after a moment he decided it had been a good one. It took knocking on 5 doors and being cursed at twice, the inhabitants of 2 cabins had gone on deck, before he found Moraine. She was fully dressed, sitting on one of the narrow beds, cross-legged, reading in her book of notes by lantern light. Back near the beginning, he saw, notes that must have been made even before she had come to Emmons Field. Lan's things were neatly placed on the other bed. I had a dream, he told her, and proceeded to tell her of it. All of it. He even pulled up his shirt to show her the small circle on his chest, red, with wavy lines radiating from it. He had kept things from her before, and he suspected he would again, but this might be too important to hold back. The pin was the smallest part of a pair of scissors, and the easiest made, but without it, the scissors cut no cloth. When he was done, he stood there waiting. She had watched him without expression, except that those dark eyes had examined every word as it came out of his mouth, weighed it, measured it, held it up to the light. Now she sat the same way, only it was he who was examined, weighed, and held up to the light. Well, is it important? He demanded finally. I think it was one of those wolf dreams you told me about. I'm sure it was. It must have been. But that doesn't make what I saw real. Only you said maybe some of the Forsaken are free, and he called her Lanfear and... Is it important, or am I standing here making a fool out of myself? There are women, she said slowly, who would do their best to gentle you if they heard what I just did. His lungs seemed to freeze. He could not breathe. I am not accusing you of being able to channel, she went on, and the ice inside him melted. Or even of being able to learn. An attempted gentling would not harm you, beyond the rough treatment the Red Aja would give you before they realize their error. Such men are so rare, even the Reds, with all their hunting, have not found more than 3 in the last 10 years. Before the outbreak of false dragons, at least. What I am trying to make clear to you is that I do not think you will suddenly begin wielding the power. You do not have to be afraid of that.
Well, thank you very much for that, he said bitterly. You do not have to scare me to death just so you can tell me there was no need to be frightened.
Oh, you do have reason to be frightened, or at least careful, as the wolf suggested. Red sisters or others might kill you before they discovered there was nothing to gentle in you.
Light burn me!
He stared at her with a frown.
You're trying to lead me around by the nose, Moraine, but I am no calf, and there's no ring in my nose. The Red Aja or any other would not think of gentling unless there was something real in what I dreamed. Does it mean the Forsaken are loose?
I told you before that they might be, some of them. Your dreams are nothing I expected, Perrin. Dreamers have written of wolves, but I did not expect this.
Well, I think it was real. I think I saw something that really happened, something I wasn't supposed to see.
What you must see.
I think Lanfear is loose at the very least. What are you going to do?
I am going to Ilion, and then I will go to Tyr and hope to reach it before Rand. We had need to leave Remen too quickly for Lan to learn whether he crossed the river or went down it. We should know before we reach Ilion, though. We will find sign if he has gone this way. She glanced at her book as if she wanted to resume her reading.
Is that all you are going to do? with Lanfear loose, and the light alone knows how many of the others?
Do not question me, she said coldly. You do not know which questions to ask, and you would comprehend less than half the answers if I gave them, which I will not.
He shifted his feet under her gaze until it became clear she would say no more on the matter. His shirt rubbed painfully at the burn on his chest. It did not seem a bad hurt. Not for being struck by lightning, it doesn't. But how he had come by it was another matter. Will you heal this?
Are you no longer uneasy about the one power being used on you then, Perrin?
No, I will not heal it. It is not serious, and it will remind you of the need to be careful. Careful about pressing her, he knew, as well as about dreams or letting others know of them.
If there is nothing else, Perrin?
He started for the door, then stopped.
There is one thing. If you knew a woman's name was Zareen, would you think it meant anything about her?
Why under the light do you ask this question?
A girl, he said awkwardly. A young woman. I met her last night. She's one of the other passengers.
He would let her discover for herself that Zareen knew she was Aes Sedai, and seemed to think following them would lead her to the Horn of Valyr. He would not keep back anything he thought was important, but if Moraine could be secretive, so could he.
Zareen, it is a Saldaean name. No woman would name her daughter that unless she expected her to be a great beauty and a heartbreaker. One to lie on cushions in palaces, surrounded by servants and suitors.
She smiled, briefly, but with great amusement.
Perhaps you have another reason to be careful, Perrin, if there is a Zareen as a passenger with us.
I intend to be careful, he told her. At least he knew why Zareen did not like her name. Hardly fitting for a hunter of the horn.
As long as she doesn't call herself Falcon.
When he went on deck, Lan was there, looking over Mondarb, and Zareen was sitting on a coil of rope near the railing, sharpening one of her knives and watching him. The big triangular sails were set and taut, and the snow goose flew downriver. Zareen's eyes followed Perrin as he walked by her to stand in the bow. The water curled to either side of the prow, like earth turning around a good plow. He wondered about dreams and Aielman, men's viewings and falcons. His chest hurt. Life had never been as tangled as this. Rand sat up out of his exhausted sleep, gasping, the cloak he had used as a blanket falling away. His side ached, the old wound from Falma throbbing. His fire had burned down to coals with only a few wavering flames, but it was still enough to make the shadows move.
That was Perrin. It was. It was him, not a dream. Somehow, I almost killed him. Light, I have to be careful.
Shivering, he picked up a length of oak branch and started to shove it into the coals. The trees were scattered in these Mirandian hills, still close to the Manetheran Drell, but he had found just enough fallen branches for his fire, the wood just old enough to be properly cured but not rotten. Before the wood touched the coals, he stopped. There were horses coming, 10 or a dozen of them walking slowly.
I have to be careful. I cannot make another mistake.
The horses swung toward his failing fire, entered the dim light, and stopped. The shadows obscured their riders, but most seemed to be rough-faced men, wearing round helmets and long leather jerkins, sewn all over with metal discs like fish scales. One was a woman with graying hair and a no-nonsense look on her face. Her dark dress was plain wool, but the finest weave, and adorned with a silver pin in the shape of a lion. A merchant, she seemed to him. He had seen her sort among those who came to buy tobacco and wool in the two rivers. A merchant and her guards.
I have to be careful, he thought as he stood. No mistakes.
You have chosen a good campsite, young man, she said. I have often used it on my way to Remen. There is a small spring nearby. I trust you have no objection to my sharing it.
Her guards were already dismounting, hitching at their sword belts and loosening saddle girths.
None, Rand told her. Careful.
Two steps brought him close enough, and he leaped into the air, spinning. Thistledown floats on the whirlwind.
Heronmark blade carved from fire, coming into his hands to take her head off before surprise could even form on her face.
She was the most dangerous.
He alighted as the woman's head rolled from the crupper of her horse. The guards yelled and clawed for their swords, screamed as they realized his blade burned. He danced among them in the forms Lan had taught him, and knew he could have killed all 10 with ordinary steel, but the blade he wielded was part of him. The last man fell, and it had been so like practicing the forms that he had already begun the sheathing called folding the fan, before he remembered he wore no scabbard, and this blade would have turned it to ash at a touch if he had. Letting the sword vanish, he turned to examine the horses. Most had run away, but some not far, and the woman's tall gelding stood with rolling eyes, wickering uneasily. Her headless corpse, lying on the ground, had maintained its grip on the reins and held the animal's head down. Rand pulled them free, pausing only to gather his few belongings before swinging into the saddle.
I have to be careful, he thought as he looked over the dead. No mistakes.
The power still filled him, the flow from Sidene sweeter than honey, ranker than rotted meat. Abruptly, he channeled, not really understanding what it was he did or how, only that it seemed right, and it worked, lifting the corpses. He set them in a line facing him, kneeling, faces in the dirt. For those who had faces left. Kneeling to him. If I am the dragon reborn, he told them, that is the way it is supposed to be, isn't it? Letting go of Sidene was hard, but he did it.
If I hold it too much, how will I keep the madness away?
He laughed bitterly. Or is it too late for that? Frowning, he peered at the line. He had been sure there were only 10 men, but 11 men knelt in that line, one of them without armor of any sort, but with a dagger still gripped in his hand.
You chose the wrong company, Rand told that man.
Wheeling the gelding, he dug in his heels and set the animal to a dead gallop into the night. It was a long way to Tyr yet, but he meant to get there by the straightest way if he had to kill horses or steal them.
I will put an end to it, the taunting, the baiting. I will end it, Kalandor.
It called to him.
Chapter 37 Fires in Cairhien. Egwene returned a graceful nod to the respectful bow of the ship's crewman who padded past her barefoot on his way to pull a rope that already seemed taut, possibly shifting a trifle the way one of the big square sails set. As he trotted back toward where the round-faced captain stood by the tillerman, he bowed again, and she nodded once more before returning her attentions to the forested Cairhien shore, separated from the blue crane by less than 20 spans of water. A village was sliding past, or what had been a village once. Half the houses were only smoldering piles of rubble with chimneys sticking starkly out of the ruins. On the other houses, doors swung with the wind, and pieces of furniture, bits of clothing, and houseware littered the dirt street, tumbled about as if thrown. Nothing living moved in the village except for one half-starved dog that ignored the passing ship as it trotted out of sight behind the toppled walls of what appeared to have been an inn. She could never see such a sight without a queasiness settling in her belly, but she tried to maintain the dispassionate serenity she thought an Aes Sedai might have. It did not help much. Beyond the village, a thick plume of smoke was rising into the sky, 3 or 4 miles off, she estimated. This was not the first such plume of smoke she had seen since the Arinen began to flow along the border of Cairhien, nor the first such village. At least this time there were no bodies in sight. Captain Elisor sometimes had to sail close to the Cairhienan shore because of mudflats. He said they shifted in this part of the river, but however close he came, she had not seen a single living person. The village and the smoke plume slipped away behind the ship, but already another column of smoke was coming into view ahead, further from the river. The forest was thinning, ash and leather leaf and black elder giving way to willow and white wood and water oak, and some she did not recognize. The wind caught her cloak, but she let it stream, feeling the cold cleanness of the air, feeling the freedom of wearing brown instead of any sort of white, though it had not been her first choice. Yet dress and cloak were of the best wool, well cut and well sewn. Another sailor trotted by, bowing as he went. She vowed to learn at least some of what it was they were doing. She did not like feeling ignorant. Wearing her great serpent ring on her right hand made for a good deal of bowing with a captain and crew born mainly in Tar Valon. She had won that argument with Nynaeve, though Nynaeve had been sure she herself was the only one of the three of them old enough for people to believe she was Aes Sedai. But Nynaeve had been wrong. Egwene was ready to admit that both she and Elaine had received startled looks on boarding the Blue Crane that afternoon at South Harbor, and Captain Ellisor's eyebrows had climbed almost to where his hair would have begun, had he had any. But he had been all smiles and bows.
"An honor, Aes Sedai! Three Aes Sedai to travel on my vessel? An honor indeed! I promise you a quick journey as far as you wish, and no trouble with Kyrian and brigands. I no longer put in on that side of the river. Unless you wish it, of course, Aes Sedai. Andoran soldiers do hold a few towns on the Kyrianan side. An honor, Aes Sedai."
His eyebrows had shot up again when they asked for just one cabin among them. Not even Nynaeve wanted to be alone at night if she did not have to be. Each could have a cabin to herself at no extra charge, he told them. He had no other passengers, his cargo was aboard, and if Aes Sedai had urgent business downriver, he would not wait even an hour for anyone else who might want passage. They said again that one cabin would be sufficient. He was startled, and it had been plain from his face that he did not understand, but Chin Ellisor, born and bred in Tar Valon, was not one to question Aes Sedai once they made their intentions clear. If two of them seemed very young, well, some Aes Sedai were young. The abandoned ruins vanished behind Egwene. The column of smoke drew closer, and there was a hint of another much further still from the riverbank. The forest was turning to low, grassy hills dotted with thickets. Trees that made flowers in the spring had them, tiny white blossoms on snowberry and bright red sugarberry. One tree she did not know was covered in round white flowers bigger than her two hands together. Occasionally a climbing wild rose put swaths of yellow or white through branches thick with the green of leaves and the red of new growth. It was all too sharp a contrast to the ashes and rubble to be entirely pleasant. Egwene wished she had an Aes Sedai to question herself right then, one she could trust. Brushing her pouch with her fingers, she could barely feel the twisted stone ring of the Turangrial inside. She had tried it every night but two since leaving Tar Valon, and it had not worked the same way twice. Oh, she always found herself in Telairan Riod, but the only thing she saw that might have been any use was the heart of the stone again, each time without Sylvie to tell her things. There was certainly nothing about the Black Aja. Her own dreams, without the Turangrial, had been filled with images that seemed almost like glimpses of the unseen world. Rand holding a sword that blazed like the sun, till she could hardly see that it was a sword, could hardly make out that it was him at all. Rand threatened in a dozen ways, none of them the least bit real. In one dream he had been on a huge stones board, the black and white stones as big as boulders, and him dodging the monstrous hands that moved them and seemed to try to crush him under them. It could have meant something, it very probably did, but beyond the fact that Rand was in danger from someone or to someone's, she thought that much was clear, beyond that she simply did not know. "I cannot help him now. I have my own duty. I don't even know where he is, except that it is probably 500 leagues from here." She had dreamed of Perrin with a wolf and with a falcon and a hawk, and the falcon and the hawk fighting, of Perrin running from someone deadly, and Perrin stepping willingly over the edge of a towering cliff while saying, "It must be done. I must learn to fly before I reach the bottom." There had been one dream of an Aiel, and she thought that had to do with Perrin too, but she was not sure, and a dream of Min, springing a steel trap but somehow walking through it without so much as seeing it. There had been dreams of Matt, too, of Matt with dice spinning round him. She felt she knew where that one came from. Of Matt being followed by a man who was not there. She still did not understand that. There was a man following, or maybe more than one, but in some way there was no one there. Of Matt riding desperately toward something unseen in the distance that he had to reach, and Matt with a woman who seemed to be tossing fireworks about. An illuminator, she assumed, but that made no more sense than anything else. She'd had so many dreams that she was beginning to doubt them all. Maybe it had to do with using the Turangrial so often, or maybe with just carrying it. Maybe she was finally learning what a dreamer did. Frantic dreams, hectic dreams, men and women breaking out of a cage, then putting on crowns, a woman playing with puppets, and another dream where the strings on puppets led to the hands of larger puppets, and their strings led to still greater puppets, on and on until the last strings vanished into unimaginable heights. Kings dying, queens weeping, battles raging, white cloaks ravaging the two rivers. She'd even dreamed of the Shan-Chan again, more than once. Those she shut away in a dark corner. She would not let herself think of them. Her mother and father, every night. She was certain what that meant, at least, or thought she was. It means I'm off hunting the Black Aja, and I do not know what my dreams mean or how to make the fool Turangrial do what it should, and I'm frightened and homesick. For an instant she thought how good it would be to have her mother send her up to bed, knowing everything would be better in the morning. Only mother can't solve my problems for me anymore, and father can't promise to chase away monsters and make me believe it. I have to do it myself now. How far in the past all that was now. She did not want it back, not really, but it had been a warm time, and it seemed so long ago. It would be wonderful just to see them again, to hear their voices, when I wear this ring on the finger I choose by right. She had finally let Nynaeve and Elaine each try sleeping one night with the stone ring, surprised at how reluctant she had been to let it out of her own hands, and they had awakened to speak of what was surely Telaran Riod, but neither had seen more than a glimpse of the heart of the stone, nothing that was of any use. The thick column of smoke now lay abreast of the Blue Crane, perhaps 5 or 6 miles from the river, she thought. The other was only a smudge on the horizon. It could almost have been a cloud, but she was sure it was not. Small thickets grew tight along the riverbank in some places, and between them the grass came right down to the water except where an undercut bank had fallen in. Elaine came on deck and joined her at the rail, the wind whipping her dark cloak as well. She wore sturdy wool, too. That had been one argument Nynaeve won, their clothes. Egwene had maintained that Aes Sedai always wore the best, even when they traveled. She'd been thinking of the silks she wore in Telairun Riod. But Nynaeve pointed out that even with as much gold as the Amyrlin had left in the back of her wardrobe, and it was a fat purse, they still had no idea how much things would cost downriver. The servants said Matt had been right about the civil war in Cairhien and what it had done to prices. To Egwene's surprise, Elaine had pointed out that brown sisters wore wool more often than silk. Elaine had been so eager to be away from the kitchen, Egwene thought, she would have worn rags. I wonder how Matt is doing. No doubt trying to dice with the captain for whatever ship he's traveling on. Terrible, Elaine murmured. It is so terrible. What is? Egwene said absently. I hope he isn't showing that paper we gave him around too freely. Elaine gave her a startled look and then a frown. That? She gestured toward the distant smoke. How can you ignore it? I can ignore it because I do not want to think of what the people are going through, because I cannot do anything about it, and because we have to reach Tyr, because what we're hunting is in Tyr. She was surprised at her own vehemence. I can't do anything about it, and the Black Aja is in Tyr. The more she thought of it, the more certain she became that they would have to find a way into the heart of the stone. Perhaps no one but the High Lords of Tyr were allowed into it, but she was becoming convinced that the key to springing the Black Aja's trap and thwarting them lay in the heart of the stone. I know all of that, Egwene, but it does not stop me feeling for the Cairhienan. I have heard lectures about the wars Andor fought with Cairhien, Egwene said dryly. Bene Sedai says you and Kyrian have fought more often than any two nations except Tyr and Ilion. The other woman gave her a sidelong look. Elaine had never